You are listening to the Apex Hour, hosted by Ryan Paul on KSUU Thunder 91.1. This show allows more personal time with our guests, allowing them to give us their stories and opinions. We will also give you new music to listen to, hoping you enjoy some new sounds and genres. Welcome to this episode of the Apex Hour.
Welcome to the Apex Radio Hour. I'm producer Faith Christensen. I'm joined with Apex Director and Professor of History, Ryan Paul, and our special guest, Dr. Susan Clayton. I'm turning it over to you, Ryan.
Thank you, Faith. We are so glad to have you here with us today, Dr. Clayton. And we, for those of you who don't know, Dr. Clayton is an environmental psychologist. Is that the right word?
Sure.
That we can maybe like call you a superhero or whatever you want, a savior of the world. So what I always like to start with is kind of a how we get to now question. So can you tell us briefly a little bit about who you are, what you do, and why you do it?
Absolutely. Thanks for the question. So I've always been interested in psychology, but I was trained in a very traditional way as a social psychologist, having nothing to do with environmental issues. Got my graduate degree, didn't know anything about environmental psychology. But in my, I'm an environmentalist at heart. I care about the natural environment. You know, I grew up in the 70s. People were talking about environmental issues. So I continued to think about it, and I began to think, well, this is kind of an issue that has some psychological relevance. So I decided that I could incorporate that into my psychological research. And then one thing I think that my training has led me to do is I really listen to people. I pay attention to what I hear people saying, and I heard them saying things that sounded like the natural environment had significant psychological impacts for them. It had emotional relevance, it had personal significance. So I really started doing research along those lines. And then still some time ago, you know, earlier in this century, in the 2000s, I guess, started to be more aware, like many of us, of climate change and started to think about that as a problem and what the psychological significance of those environmental changes might be, given that I had already been thinking about the psychological significance of the environment. And it's been quite a journey. It's been very interesting. It's been in many ways rewarding to kind of bring this aspect of climate change to more public attention. And there's certainly lots of questions that I still want to investigate about the impacts of climate change on psychology.
So climate change, I mean, has obviously been looked at from a variety of ways, historically, obviously scientifically, not that psychology isn't a science, but you know what I mean, those kinds of things, environmentally. So in your work, how do you distinguish what you're doing? How is this a new way to look at climate change?
Well, I think historically the people studying climate change have been focused on the impacts on ecosystems, on weather, on non-human species for the most part, on water cycles and agriculture and all kinds of things that weren't very human, with relatively little attention to human impacts. And when we did look at human impacts, it tended to be economic impacts, you know, what are the effects of being hit by extreme weather events on infrastructure and so on. Very little attention was being paid to individual psychology and how people's emotional responses, their behavioral responses. So that's what I've helped, I think, to bring attention to those individual responses to climate change.
So what has been some of the most surprising things that you found about that relationship mm-hmm. to climate change?
The thing that surprised me most when I really first started to dive into this research was how much evidence there already was that people's mental health was being impaired by climate changes. I thought it was new and we didn't know very much, but it turns out we have lots of evidence about the impacts of extreme weather, for example. So that was new. And then just the more I looked at it, the more wide-ranging those environmental impacts are, everything from your cognitive functioning, to your mental state, to your social relationships, all of those things can be affected by climate.
Now, I heard you speak earlier today, and one of the things that I found interesting that I had never thought about was the social relationship impact from not only Indigenous people, but people in general due to climate change. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, to some extent. And I would say this is a pretty new area of research, but the idea is that the ways people relate to each other can be affected by environmental conditions. And you brought up indigenous peoples. They are, I think, recognized as having, in many cases, very intricate, deep relationships with the natural environment, a lot of cultural practices that might involve particular native foods, foods that are native to the area, various rituals that are tied to the changing seasons. Non-indigenous peoples have some of the same kinds of practices, but it's much more, I think, obvious and, at a clear-cut level where it might have been buried under, other influences for, more standard Western societies. So when the environment starts to change, things that you take for granted, and some examples that might, be understandable to a lot of people might be if you're, if you're in Washington, D.C., which is an area close to where I was born, you think about the cherry blossom festival. What happens? How do you feel if the cherry blossoms start to bloom earlier? How does that affect the way you set up your schedule? Does that change the way you feel about the place? So just some of those impacts of changing natural environments on how you think about the place, and then maybe you come together with other people to celebrate those changing seasons. How does the fact that the changes are different than they used to be impair your kind of cultural traditions? And in a more specific interpersonal relationship, being hot just makes people irritable and aggressive. You see rises in interpersonal aggression, and evidence that being in healthy natural settings can promote positive social relationships. So people are nicer to each other if they feel inspired by their local environment. So those are some of the kinds of things.
So I mean, it seems one of the things that I the example that you used earlier that I really hadn't thought about was this idea of cultures that live in the cold, mm-hmm. right? And that when it's super cold, I can take my snow machine or whatever across the frozen lake and visit people. But if that lake never freezes all the way, that those relationships are severed. And I don't think we think about it in that term.
Yeah, that was something too. When I first heard of it, it just hadn't occurred to me. I thought, I think because, I like to be warm. I think, surely people who live in the far north will be a little bit happier if it gets warmer. But no, it turns out that there are some very practical barriers to just the kinds of social interactions they like to have are a consequence of the warming temperatures.
So what do we get wrong about climate change? I mean, obviously, it's something that has become very politicized and everyone has an opinion on it in one way or another. But overall, in your mind, what do we not still fail to understand about it?
Well, you could answer that question in a bunch of ways. I think one thing we get wrong is how fundamentally people will be affected. I think many of us still feel kind of, that we'll be buffered, we'll be safe, we won't be affected. And I don't mean to be, fatalistic. I don't think we're all going to be, destroyed, but I think we are all going to be affected. Another important thing, though, is I think there's partly because of the emphasis on let's not exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius increase. People sort of think, okay, if we exceed that, the fight is lost. And that's a really bad way of understanding it. It's an ongoing thing. Everything we can do to reduce the amount of warming is good, even if it ends up being, can we make the difference between 1.7 and 1.8 degrees? And we might go over 1.5 and then bring it back down. So it's not just you cross this threshold and everything is over.
So what do you say to people who will say, well, it's just cyclical, that at some point the wheel will turn around and all will be well? Is it, well, you're not going to survive to that point? Or what do you say to that?
I'd say two things. One is, well, it may be cyclical, but as you kind of hinted at there, that doesn't mean that we're not going to be negatively affected by the downturn of the cycle. So, sure, if it gets warmer now and then in 10,000 years it gets colder again, does that really make me feel any better? No. But probably more importantly, I would say, you know, I'm not a climate scientist. I'm not a geoscientist. I listen to the people who study that stuff and who know, and they say, no, it's not cyclical, you know, not within any frame of reference that has meaning to us. We have clear evidence not just of change, but of linking that change to human influences on the environment.
So when I've been thinking about this based upon our conversations, when I went to grad school, I wanted to study history of rock and roll and how rock and roll changed things. And I had a very dear mentor, this was in the 90s, who said to me, well, you know, Ryan, many of the people you work with will say that's not history, right? And he was right. And now, of course, everyone wants to talk about that as people get older. And I'm wondering, when you started thinking about environmental psychology, did you have that same pushback from people? This really isn't psychology. This is something else.
Absolutely, I did. And thanks for asking that question. Now, I want to sort of distinguish the field of environmental psychology. Very broadly defined, is just the impact of the physical environment on people. That's been around since the 50s. A focus on what sometimes is even called climate psychology or conservation psychology, slightly different overlapping definitions there. The idea that psychology has something relevant to say about climate change, I got a ton of pushback. Two things stand out in my mind. One was an early effort I made to talk to different branches of the American Psychological Association about whether they had environmental policies. So I surveyed all, you know, maybe 52 divisions, and I got some very supportive letters in response, but I also got, I wrote to the secretaries of the divisions. I got some supportive letters, and I got one that said, what on earth does psychology have to do with environmental issues? And that was a very strong perspective in the psychology community and also in the environmental community. They just didn't understand what they had to do with each other. And my first environmental book, Identity in the Natural Environment, I shopped around to multiple publishers, and they just didn't know what to do with it because their environmental studies editors didn't know anything about psychology, and their psychology editors didn't know anything about environmental issues. So it really, there was not a receptive audience for that kind of message, and there were many years. And I say this to encourage other people who might, as you and I did, kind of push the boundaries. Many years where I was giving talks at conferences, and there would be, you know, if I was lucky, four people in the audience.
So why do you think people are so passionate about this? Mm-hmm. On both sides, right? I mean, there's people who are very passionate about this issue in a way that we need to do something, and there are other people who are, I would say, probably equally as passionate about this is not something that we need to think about. There are more pressing problems. Why is this such a passionate issue for people?
Oh, that's kind of overdetermined. I think one reason is that when we talk about environmental changes, we're talking about something so fundamental that it challenges people's entire view of the world. And so for some people, some religious traditions, for example, they just can't accept the idea that humans can influence the natural world. That contradicts everything they've been taught in their tradition. So they reject the entire idea, and they may feel offended by the idea. Other people deny it because it conflicts with other kind of ideological positions. But for the people who accept it, there's also that sense that it changes everything. It changes everything I believe to be true and know to be true about how the world works. And so that creates a lot of emotion too, that idea that human activity can be interfering with something so fundamental.
And I think that word fundamental is interesting because it also could mean divine, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what you're really saying is that I'm not telling you what you're saying, but ultimately some people that I know say, well, God gave us stewardship over the earth, and therefore we know that it will always be in abundance and everything else. And I've often thought that's a pretty naive way to think that humans, that's a misunderstanding of the word stewardship, right? And what I find interesting is that a part of my own faith tradition, the church itself are actively doing things to become green, for a better word, or have strong environmental positions. They just don't publicize them as much, and I would think that many people would be shocked to see what's happening in that regard, right? That stewardship means something a lot different. And to your point, I think that this connection of how intimately we are connected with our environment. I mean, I'd like you to explain a little more about this idea of identity in the natural environment. What exactly does that mean in that regard?
It means different things to different people. And for some people, it may be a very religious understanding that, you know, humans were created and the rest of the natural environment were created by the same entity and to work together. For other people, it might be a recognition, maybe people who have a more, biological background, that ecosystems, that humans are part of ecosystems and not separate. And so human actions affect other parts of the ecosystem. Other parts of the ecosystem affect human. We're not set aside and separate. For a lot of people, it is really that broader sense that they are part of something larger. And this is something that I really began to appreciate, again, hearing the kinds of comments people would make about what they felt like when they were out in the natural world. They would say, I feel like I'm part of everything. I feel like I'm connected to everything. So I think that's a very powerful recognition for people, and it's good for us to be reminded of it.
So essentially, we are more interdependent on our ecosystem and environment in the natural world than we generally are led to believe.
Absolutely. I think, I don't want to say everybody, but many of us are kind of taught this view of the world that has humans at the top and maybe set aside. And we think that we're responsible for providing the requirements of our own lives. We think we grow our own food and we build our own houses, and we do, but we rely on the rest of nature. You know, we can't grow our own food without a lot of help from other parts of the system, including something as simple as pollinators. You know, a lot of agricultural work is done by bees and other insects and birds that will all play a part in disseminating the seeds and so on. So we are taught that we're doing it ourselves, but we're not really doing it ourselves. We're doing it as part of a system.
Thank you for that. Let's take our first break. And for those of you who listen to the podcast, know that we invite each of our guests to choose some songs that resonate with them in one way or another, and let them tell us a little bit about them. So as we go into this break, the first, I got to tell you, I have been very pleased and very impressed with the songs that you chose, and I don't know that I would have chosen those for you. So well done. I think these are good. So the first song we're going to listen to is Feels Like Summer by Childish Gambino. And if you haven't heard the music of Childish Gambino, you deserve to create a playlist. So why did you choose this particular song?
Well, I'll be honest, my son sent me this one, and because he knew I was interested in climate change, and he thought I would enjoy seeing the pop culture reference. But it's kind of a fascinating song to me because there's this undertone, there's a dark undertone of something feels not quite right, but it's not really articulated overtly. It's just like, oh yeah, it's warm, feels like summer. We all like summer. So I think that gets at kind of the ways a lot of us think about climate change, like this very subtle sense that something's not quite right, but we don't really confront it head on.
Okay. This is Feels Like Summer by Childish Gambino.
Summer, I feel like summer, I feel like summer.
That was Feels Like Summer by Childish Gambino. You are listening to the Apex Radio Hour here on KSUU Thunder 91.1. I'll turn it back to you, Ryan.
Thank you, Faith. We're here with Dr. Susan Clayton, a environmental psychologist studying psychology and climate change. And I have a question. One of my colleagues and I was chatting about this, or had mentioned it to me, that he had once heard someone say that climate change was blasphemous, right? And I'm wondering how you respond to people who say, and we talked about that there are people who believe passionate about it, but what do you say to someone who comes up and says, you know, Dr. Clayton, climate change is blasphemous?
And I guess that they're saying that because of that idea that it suggests that humans can impair something God has wrought, and we that's arrogant, and we shouldn't feel that way. My first reaction would be, of course, to argue with them and say, well, but it's happening, and here's the data. But in fact, I don't think that would be the most effective approach, probably. I think I would try to talk to them on terms that maybe we could both agree with. And we were talking a minute ago about the idea of stewardship. A lot of religious traditions include that sense that the natural environment is a gift, or it's something that has been provided, perhaps, to humans and for humans. And what do you do with that, with a gift that's been given to you by a divine creator? Well, you take care of it. You don't trash it. I mean, that seems just logical to me. So I think that many, if not all, religious traditions can understand and endorse the idea of care for the natural world. And that would probably be the tack I'd try to take.
I think it's interesting. I just thought about this, that if, well, how can we impact something that God has created? Well, I mean, we can beat somebody up. I mean, you can kill another human mm-hmm. being. I mean, that's impacting someone that God, you know, that God created. So if you can do that, then why couldn't you do that to an environmental structure?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so I was just thinking about that. So I want to talk about your own personal relationship to the natural world. I mean, how do you personally connect in that way?
Good question. I will say I don't do it in any deliberate way. I just find that being out in nature calms me and gives me joy, and I really enjoy, especially this time of year in spring, I just love going outside and watching things grow, watching new birds come back to my backyard or new insects. I think part of what I enjoy about it is the fact that it's so I'm not responsible for it. It just happens. I don't have to do anything to make sure that spring returns. It's just something that feels like a gift. And then it's just so fascinating. There's always something new to see or hear or smell or feel. I don't get bored when I'm out in nature. It's a nice restorative place for me.
So I'm curious as to where you grew up.
Yeah, I grew up in Maryland, not far from Washington, D.C., so it wasn't exactly the wilderness, but I was fortunate to grow up sort of surrounded by a lot of nature. There was a creek behind my house. I was across the street from a state park where I spent a lot of time just wandering around on the trails. So I think definitely, I don't know if I was unusual, but I was able to spend a lot of time as a child, playing in the creek, looking at bugs and tortoises and snakes and frogs and things.
So when you were a kid doing that, did you say to yourself, you know what I want to do for a living? I want to study people's minds. I mean, what did you want to be when you were younger? What's the first thing you remember wanting to be when you grew up?
Well, I actually wanted to be a writer. Yep. And that lasted for a while. But it was in high school. I mean, I think many people, when you're in your elementary school, psychologist is not one of the things on your list. You're like, astronaut, firefighter, doctor, writer, teacher, nurse. So I wanted to be a writer. But when I just learned that there was such a thing as psychology, probably in high school, I thought, yeah, that's appealing.
So that was your moment of where you realized this is kind of what I want to do and pursue that?
A little bit, although I kind of made that decision without really understanding what psychology was. You know, a lot of high schools at that point, and I think still, don't have psychology classes. So I thought, well, I don't want to do this Freudian stuff, but I think the idea of studying human beings, that sounds like fun. So it wasn't until college that I really actually learned what psychology included.
So now there are obviously, there are lots of sub-disciplines of psychology, but there are clinical psychologists and what would you say, academic psychologists? What's the definition? How do you split those apart?
Yeah, you could divide it up multiple ways. Often, you know, applied psychology versus research psychology, or, you know, clinical psychologists versus other kinds of psychology is a big, you know, people who focus on mental health and everyone else would be another way of dividing it up.
So Are there other areas of interest in psychology that you're kind of fascinated by, or is this kind of where you're hanging your hat from here on out?
Well, I can't remember if I mentioned this earlier, so I was trained as a social psychologist and particularly interested in how people process social information, very interested in issues about attitudes towards social justice, intergroup relations, stereotypes, prejudice, those kinds of things. And I never lost interest in those, but we have a limited amount of time in our lives. And when I began to move into the environmental area, I realized that this was going to take all of my time. And there are plenty of other people doing research in these other areas, so I could kind of leave that up to them.
So, and you talked about this earlier today, but as we think about climate change, obviously it becomes a very overwhelming thing, right? Like if I'm using LED light bulbs and 50 of my neighbors are not, what's the, you know, does that really matter? Or it can be a very disheartening thing to think about this. Sometimes people think I'm a voice in the wilderness. And I think there are more people that agree than others. Unfortunately, it takes sometimes a big thing to make us, you know, in our part of the world, the Great Salt Lake, right, is really causing a lot of people to say, we need to think about how this is going to relate. But what can we do? I mean, if it is true, and which you said that it is, that heat and climate change can impact us to our very core, not just the biology, but how we see ourselves in the world, right, how we define our identity, what do we do individually and collectively besides, like, I'll turn off the light when you leave, or don't leave the water running?
Yeah, I think that's a question that a lot of people that it find daunting. It kind of stops them maybe from doing what they might otherwise have done. I want to suggest that we, even though we are strongly affected by our environmental conditions, that doesn't mean we are only affected by our environmental conditions. We have a lot of agency, and we can decide what kind of people we want to be in the world. Do we want to be people who bury our heads in the sand? Do we want to be people who give up, or do we want to be people who are actively involved in trying to cope and to make things better? And so it's not just about the effect you have on the problem, it's about the effect you have on yourself. And I think it's a good thing for all of us to not feel hopeless, and to not deny reality, but to say, okay, given this reality, here's the kind of role I want to play in it. And it doesn't mean we all have to be out there marching on Washington or, you know, boycotting particular industries. It can just be, I want to help my community be more resilient to the effects of flooding or to the effects of wildfire smoke. I want to get together with a group of people and see, how can we maybe reduce the threat to the Great Salt Lake, or if not, adjust to those changes.
You've talked a lot about resilience. I mean, you've used that word multiple times. And I think that what comes to mind in my mind, and I have mentioned this before, is that, you know, as I study history, especially in the world in which we live today, a lot of people say, well, it sounds very depressing, you know, if it's think about cycles and everything else, which I don't necessarily believe in. But ultimately, I find history to be a very hopeful thing, right? Very negative, I can find more than one positive, that we are generally a species that works to the betterment of the community, not just the betterment of the individual, right? And I was thinking about this listening to George Takei, you know, from Star Trek. He was interred in an internment camp, and he wrote a book about it. It's a graphic novel, actually. And he talked about his dad, and he said, my dad was resilient. And oftentimes we think of resilience as just, you know, like Boxer from Animal Farm, like just plodding along. But resilient people move forward with hope, right? And I think that's the challenge, is because sometimes climate activists are seen as moving forward with anger and fear and venom, same on the other side, versus we need to be better. I mean, we can look forward for hope, right? I mean, wouldn't you?
Yes, I'm really glad you put it that way, because I think we do need, and I do have a vision for a future. It's not just where we minimize how terrible things are, but we actually work to improve things. And I think many people, maybe most, would say there are many things about our current system that they're not satisfied with. It might be the extent of economic inequality. It might be a lifestyle where you spend, you know, 3 hours a day in your car commuting to work. It might be the long hours you spend at work. It might be threats to physical health that are posed by our current lifestyle. So there's room for improvement. And I think we can improve some aspects of our current lifestyle along with and maybe as part of working to address the climate crisis. So I think an example that I might often give is just if we drive less, walk more, guess what? Not only does that reduce the extent of climate change, it improves our physical health, it improves our mental health. We are more likely to see more people and talk to more people and have a greater sense of community. I think most people would agree that those are positive lifestyle changes. So I think we need, it would be helpful for us to think more about the kinds of changes we would like to see in society, not just the kinds of changes we are afraid of or the kinds of changes we have to make, but we don't really want to.
Or maybe the kinds of changes that I want to see you make, but I don't want to make them.
Right.
All right, let's move on to our next break. This is a song called Won't Give Up by Patty Gagne. Did I pronounce that correctly? I hope I did. So why did you choose this song?
Well, this is an interesting song. I think I got a link to this from some environmental newsletter. It's actually a collaboration between several musicians, including Yo-Yo Ma, you know, classical cellist. And I liked it for several – I mean, I like it because I like the song. I like it because of the collaboration between people who are, you know, different generations, different kind of positions within society coming together. And I like it because they're trying to give a very positive message.
So this is – Patty Gagne with Won't Give Up.
Well, I'm not gonna say goodbye. I won't see you on the other side. Even when I feel tired, I won't stop you and I. Made up of the same things. Nature running. Even when I feel tired, I won't stop trying. I've seen the sunshine before all this gray. Always find light still, the breaking of day. give up for a minute. Never giving up on you. Never giving up on you. I won't give up for a minute. Never giving up on you. Never giving up on you.
That was Won't Give Up by Patty Gagne. You are listening to the Apex Radio Hour here on KSUU Thunder 91.1. I'll turn it back to you, Ryan.
Thank you, Faith. And we're excited again to continue our conversation with Dr. Susan Clayton. How's Ohio treating you?
Yeah, Ohio is, it's treating me pretty well.
Yeah. We should say that you're a professor at Worcester University. A liberal arts school in Ohio.
College of Worcester.
College, yes. Forgive me. And what part of Ohio is that in?
It's in Northeast Ohio, so it's between Cleveland and Columbus.
Ah, that's exciting. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yes. Yep.
There you go. So I'm interested in if I often fancy myself, one of my challenges, and my wife will tell you this, is that I'm a generalist. I mean, I'm interested in lots of different things. And if I was interested in your topic, like psychology and climate change and how it affects us, what is the – where do I begin that entry? Like what is the non-textbook work or where should I pick up to say, hey, I want to learn more?
Well, I think there are multiple points of entry. One of the books that occurs to me – that was written by a non-psychologist that a lot of people found accessible is Last Child in the Woods by Richard Louv. And he talked about nature deficit disorder, the idea that people lose something when they lose contact with the natural world. And there, he drew on a lot of actual psychological research to write his book, so psychologists were happy with him for that. It got a really big response, especially from parents who had this instinctive feeling that he was right, that if their kids didn't spend time outside, they were losing something. And I think really, to some extent, started a movement. So it's not directly about climate change, except in the sense that as the climate is changing, it might be harder for our children to find nice places to visit outside. But I think it really helped people to recognize and articulate the sense that humans belong in the natural world, and there's something wrong if we're not allowed to spend time in it.
So who, in your work, and maybe even as a young student, who was your inspiration? I mean, who were you inspired by?
I'm not sure, honestly. There were people writing about environmental identity. Mitch Thomashaw was one. And again, raising that idea that our sense of ourselves is affected by our understanding of our relationship with nature. And then E.O. Wilson, the sociobiologist, came up with the idea of biophilia, that idea that we are instinctively likely, doesn't mean it always happens, but we're kind of predisposed to form an emotional connection to the natural world. And I think that inspired me because it both described the phenomenon and provided an explanation that made sense to me, so I could kind of incorporate that into my understanding.
And he was pretty prolific in his writing, and he's fairly accessible, mm-hmm. too, right? I mean, E.O. Wilson, he when I was in college, he was pretty fundamental for me as well. So I guess what I really want you to do now is tell me it's going to be okay.
Hmm. Well, I liked what you said earlier about people being more good than bad. I'm going to summarize what you said in that way. And I fundamentally believe that. I think it's very easy to see when people do something that disappoints us. But there's so often that people do just amazing things for each other or for principles that they believe in. At some level, I'm pretty, you know, I wouldn't say 100% certain, but I think it's extremely likely that we will get our act together and start doing more to effectively address the climate crisis. I think we will experience more negative effects than we would have if we'd gotten our act together earlier. But I think we already see signs of people recognizing, oh yeah, we need to do something about this. Let's have talks. Let's at least come up with policies. Hopefully we will start living up to some of those policies.
So what does the evolution of your work look like? I mean, obviously your work is has evolved from when you started it, but what is the long-term result or what's next, I guess, is what I'm saying as you move forward?
Well, I think a step that is needed, and I will be part of this, although other people might do more than I will to advance this knowledge, is a better understanding of how to help people maintain their mental health in the face of these kinds of challenges. So to develop more effective interventions, more community programs, perhaps more educational programs that tell people about climate change and how to be resilient and how to adapt.
So that brings us to another question, is that what are some of the mental health strategies that we can implement? I mean, what are some of the tools that we can use to center ourselves and maybe collectively other people?
Mm-hmm. Depends where we're starting from. I think for people there are a lot of people who are not, I'll say, worried enough, not anxious enough. And so honestly, I think information is a good tool for all of us to make sure that we are experiencing maybe enough anxiety. For people who are experiencing too much anxiety, information can also be helpful because you do hear things on the internet, you know, that we're all going to burn up by, you know, 2030, and that's unrealistic too. So some people might be reassured to know that things are not looking quite that bad. But for people who are feeling that climate change is really threatening their mental health, I think the three most basic things I would recommend are to connect with other people, to find other people to talk to about their feelings and just kind of reassure themselves that they're not alone, that their feelings are not unreasonable, that other people also care. to get involved in doing something, because action can be a very powerful tool for mental health. It prevents you from feeling like a passive victim and allows you to, you know, to have agency and be more, feel more in control of your own life. And third, sort of to let themselves off the hook. So I think all of us feel sometimes we're not doing enough. We're frustrated by knowing that there are ways in which our individual behavior is, you know, not 100% ideal. And for some people, just feeling this overwhelming sense of responsibility. But really, the responsibility does not lie on our individual shoulders. We have to face this collectively. And as individuals, it's okay to just sometimes say, you know what, I'm just gonna go for a hike. I'm just going to go on a picnic. I'm just going to relax. Let somebody else worry about saving the world today. So none of us individually caused this problem, and none of us should feel like individually we have to save the world either.
That's a great point. I think it reminds me of something you had said earlier. You shared this post from someone about, it was millennials or Gen Z, you know, why save? It's going to blow up anyway. And it's very much kind of this eat, drink, and be merry attitude, right? It's almost like that doing nothing is the same as doing something in the negative way, right? And that can cause, I mean, that's a concerning thing. It seems like that some want us just to be paralyzed by inaction.
Absolutely. It's kind of the next front. So first there was the idea that, oh no, the climate is not changing. We don't have to do anything. And now, really, there's a very high level of acknowledgement in the public, you know, something maybe around 80% on average, just make you up the numbers a little bit, but very high, that climate change is happening. So the next defense is sort of like, yeah, it is happening, and in fact, it's too late. We can't do anything about it. And that's a terrible strategy for solving a problem, but it's a good strategy for allowing yourself to continue to do whatever you want to do. So many people are, they're motivated in a sense, in a sort of sad way, to endorse that philosophy.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we the fear is that by the time we realize that we can do something, it's too late, right? And what you're saying is that really we are not near the point of no return. We can just be. I think you put up the we can be better. You put up the doomsday clock thing today, that the doomsday clock, and we've always tied that to nuclear weapons, but now it's tied to climate science. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't pay any more attention than the average person to the doomsday clock, but I think they consider all kinds of dangers, and climate change is one of them.
So you've written many peer-reviewed articles in scientific journals. You've authored a number of books based upon this topic. You have been recognized by your peers as an expert in what you do. The Psychological Association has had you author reports. I think the UN, you did something for the UN as well. I mean, you are a world-renowned expert in this field. Did the person who wrote you that letter about you shouldn't do this, did they ever recant?
Oh, wouldn't that be? That would be like everybody's fantasy. You know, that one person who misjudged me when I was in high school now knows they were wrong. I never did get a personal letter from anybody who said, oh, I was wrong about this back in the, you know, late 90s or whatever it was. So I don't know if they did personally. However, I will say that the American Psychological Association has clearly taken a strong stance that, yes, this is relevant to psychology. Yes, we need to pay attention to it.
And as many people, I mean, universities all over the country now are teaching, you know, this fear, or graduating graduate students, professors are coming in to this field. Classes are being created using your work, and you're like the pioneer in many ways of this kind of stuff. And that's got to be fairly rewarding, right? That that has become a significant part of your discipline.
It is very rewarding, and I always feel kind of bad saying that, but this is, and I've heard this from other clients, climate scientists as well, that in the midst of all the bad news, it's kind of wonderful that the discipline that you've spent your life in is being recognized as important, and that you have the opportunity to be part of this public conversation in a way that you know, probably many of us did not anticipate when we started. So yeah, I will absolutely say that has been you know, very validating and just enjoyable.
So when the subgroup of the at the APA conference, the environmental psychologists, mm-hmm. you don't all get together in a room and say they should listen to us more.
I won't say that's never happened.
Well, speaking of listening, let's take our next and final break. This I am so glad, by the way, you chose this person. This she is an amazing talent, and I don't think there's anything that she can't do or play. But this is Rhiannon Giddens. The song is called "Tomorrow Is My Turn." Why did you choose this song?
Yeah, this one is less clearly related to climate change, but like you, I just think Rhiannon Giddens is astonishingly talented. She has an amazing voice. She's just done such interesting things in music. She's also a graduate of Oberlin College, where I lived in Oberlin for several decades, and so I feel that sort of personal hometown connection. And this song, which is actually a cover, I believe, so definitely not directed towards climate change, but that idea of focusing on, well, tomorrow is my turn, you could read that as referring to the current younger generation and the idea of the potential for change, change in social systems, change in political systems. There's a sort of, as with any of these songs, a kind of bittersweet note to the music. It's not celebratory, but it's a reminder that things can change and change for the better as new people gain power.
Cool. Thank you. So this is Rhiannon Giddens, and "Tomorrow Is My Turn."
Those who may reach for the stars, others will end behind bars. What the future has in store, no one ever knows. Though time may help you forget all that has happened before, it's too late to regret what is gone will be no more. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn. When my luck is returning, all these years I've been learning to see fingers from burning. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is receive without giving, to make life worth the living, for it's my life I'm living, and my only concern, tomorrow is my turn. When summer is gone, another to come. You can't stop years drifting by, even if you want to try. Though time may help you forget all that has happened, what is gone will be no more. But tomorrow is my turn.
No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn. When my luck is returning, all these years I've been learning to save fingers from burning. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn. To receive without giving, to make life worth the living. For it's my life I'm living. Tomorrow is my turn. No more doubts, no more fears. Tomorrow is my turn. To receive without giving, to make life worth the living. For it's my life I'm living.
That was Tomorrow Is My Turn by Rhiannon Giddens. You are listening to the Apex Radio Hour here on KSUU, Thunder 91.1. I'll turn it back to you, Ryan.
Thank you, Faith. You know, Dr. Clayton, this is an interesting time for us. As many of our listeners may or may not know, that we have a team of student workers that help produce the Apex Radio, Eccles Apex Radio Hour. And it's rare that we're all in the room together. So this is one of those moments that we're all here to answer the final question of the day. And I don't know that it'll ever happen again, quite frankly, just based upon class schedules and everything else. So as I mentioned to you, we want to know what's bringing you joy. So Dr. Susan Clayton, what are you currently watching, listening to, reading, or playing that is bringing you joy?
Well, my answer to that question, I think you'll appreciate this based on what you were telling me about your kind of intellectual history. I recently visited the Motown Museum in Detroit, where I had never been before. And so I've been listening to a lot of Motown music. Has nothing to do with climate change, but it is very happy music. And so when it comes on, or when I put it on, which is more likely, you know, I might sing along, I might dance around the house a little bit. It's just bringing me joy.
Well, thank you. Motown has everything to do with climate change, right? I mean, heat wave, they were talking about heat waves before we thought about them as a real thing. Yeah. All right, Kason Graff, my good friend, what are you currently watching, listening to, reading, or playing that is bringing you joy?
I've read the book before. I'm currently listening to it in the audiobook format for the first time. I'm Brandon Sanderson's Oathbringer. I'm rereading the series to get ready for the release of the fifth book in December. I'm really enjoying that, really liking that. It's fun catching the stuff I've missed the first time, since listening makes me slow down a little bit, catch a little bit more. And I've agreed to do drives that I probably otherwise wouldn't have agreed to, specifically so that I could listen to the book more.
Thank you. Thank you. My good friend, Sophie Javage, what are you currently watching, reading, listening to, or playing that is bringing you joy?
I think that something I kind of bring up every time you ask this question is something that I'm doing with others, because that's one of my love languages, is quality time. And my friend group has been, we've been watching all the Dunes because we're getting ready to watch the second one that just came out in theaters. And that has been very fun and entertaining to just watch everyone's reactions to what's going on and try and understand the story and all of that. So that is what's been bringing me joy.
Talk about a world ravaged by climate problems, right? Arrakis is pretty challenged. There, but for the grace of God, go we, right, Dr. Clayton?
I hope we don't get there.
All right, Faith Christensen, what are you currently watching, reading, listening to, or playing that is bringing you joy?
Well, this last weekend, I had some family in town, and my husband was out of town for an entrepreneurship competition, so I was able to hang out with my sister-in-law and my niece, and we actually went to a dance competition my niece competed in, and honestly, it brought back a lot of memories of when I did competitive cheer. It also made me think, as a lot of it was really different, as their award system was very different, as each studio that had competed received a participation trophy, and each dance that had been performed received a ranking of what level they had performed. During that time, I was very confused, but it brought back a lot of memories of when I used to compete, and it made me excited for maybe when I have a future kiddo involved in sports or performance that I'll get to cheer them on, but still be equally confused on, I don't know what's happening, but I love my kid, I love my niece, go them. So that was really fun. But Ryan, what are you currently watching, reading, listening to, or playing that is bringing you joy?
I am watching, and I watch this every week. There are things, and sacred is not the right word, but there are times, and my family will tell you this, that I dedicate to one show that I don't want to be disturbed. I'm happy for you to watch it with me, but I don't want, and Kirsten, this is my 5-year-old, and then she can disturb me. But it is this, CBS Sunday Morning. It's on every Sunday. I don't watch it live. I DVR it so I can skip the commercials. But we've talked a lot about resilience and hope, and that is one show that gives me hope for humanity. If you've never seen CBS Sunday Morning, you owe it. It's like a news magazine. It's a lifestyle show. It's just this thing that's been on for 30-some-odd years. Charles Osgood, Charles Carrault, Jane Pauley now hosts it, and it just brings these stories from culture and books and news and lifestyle and basic human kindness. There's always a story about somebody who has done something amazing for somebody else. And that is what is bringing me joy this week and every week. So with that, we'd like to thank Dr. Susan Clayton for being here with us. We're so grateful that Sophie and Kaysen have been able to join us in the studio today. And we're thanks to all of you who've listened to the Apex Radio Hour. And we're going to go out with the last song. And I got to tell you, I am so glad also you chose this group, because I haven't thought about them for some time, and that is my chagrin. And when I saw this, I started linking and listening again and looking at my phone and trying to put some stuff together. So this is The Pretenders with My City Was Gone. Can you tell me why you chose this song?
Oh, well, I felt like I kind of had to. The Pretenders are, you know, we're an Ohio band, and My City Was Gone, again, not directly about climate change, but I think and it's a great song generally, but about people making bad decisions that lead to a less good future. And just, I think, pointing out that happens. And yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Clayton. Thank you for listening. This is The Pretenders with My City Was Gone.
family was gone. I stood on the back porch. There was nobody home. I was stunned and amazed. My childhood memories sort of swirled past like the wind through the trees. Hey, oh, where to go, Ohio? City, oh, where to go, Ohio?